In Game 1, Blue took what Grandmaster Robert Byrne called crazy chances. On-site expert commentators labeled one move insane. It wasn't. It was exactly right. Here's what happened. Late in the game, Blue's king was under savage attack by Kasparov. Any human player under such assault by a world champion would be staring at his own king, trying to figure out how to get away. Instead, Blue ignored the threat and quite nonchalantly went hunting for lowly pawns at the other end of the board. In fact, at the point of maximum peril, Blue expended two moves. Many have died giving Kasparov even one to snap one pawn. It was as if at Gettysburg, General Meade had sent his soldiers out for a bit of apple picking moments before Pickett's charge because he had calculated that they could get back to their positions with a half second to spare. In humans, that's called sang-froid. And if you don't have any sang, you can be very froid. But then again, if Meade had known absolutely, by calculating the precise trajectories of all the bullets and all the bayonets and all the cannons in Pickett's division, the time of arrival of the enemy, he could indeed, without fear, have ordered his men to pick apples. Which is exactly what Deep Blue did. It had calculated every possible combination of Kasparov's available moves and determined with absolute certainty that it could return from its pawn-picking expedition and destroy Kasparov exactly one move before Kasparov could destroy it, which it did. It takes more than nerves of steel to do that. It takes a silicon brain. No human can achieve absolute certainty, because no human can be sure to have seen everything. Deep Blue can. Now, it cannot see everything forever, just everything within its horizon, which for Deep Blue means everything that can happen within the next 10 or 15 moves or so. The very best human player could still beat it, as Kasparov did subsequently, because he can intuit, God knows how, what the general shape of things will be 20 moves from now. But it is only a matter of time before, having acquired yet more sheer computing power, Blue will see farther than Gary can feel. And then it's curtains. Then he gets shut out 6-0. Then we don't even bother to play the brutes again. The world championship will consist of one box playing another. Men stopped foot racing against automobiles long ago. Blue's omniscience will make it omnipotent. It can play, fight, with the abandon of an immortal. Kasparov himself said that with Deep Blue, quantity had become quality. When you can calculate so fast and so far, you rise to another level. At some point, that happened in biology. There are neurons firing in lemmings and squid, but put them together in gigantic enough numbers and fantastic enough array, as in humans, and behold a thought popping up like a cartoon bubble from the brain. We call that consciousness. Deep Blue is not there yet, though one day we will be tempted to ask him. In the meantime, he's done alchemy, turning quantity into quality. That in itself is scary, at least to me. However, my son, age 10, who lives as comfortably with his computer as he does with his dog, was rooting for Deep Blue all along. "What are you worried about, Dad?" he says. "After all, we made the machine, didn't we? So we're just beating ourselves." The next generation has gone over to them. No need to wait for the rematch. It's over. Time, February 26, 1996. The best show in town. In that fleeting interval between natural disaster, earthquake, hurricane, and the president's 57th or so major national address next Thursday, I can finally devote a summer column to the finest efflorescence of that season this city has to offer, the Washington Nationals. They are a baseball team. Not yet very good, mind you, but it matters not. When you live in a town with a great team, you go to see them win. When you live in a town with a team that is passing rapidly through mediocrity on its way to contention, the Nats have an amazing crop of upcoming young players, you go for the moments. I go to see Ryan Zimmerman charge a slowly hit grounder down the third baseline. This happens roughly once a game. Zim comes flying in, picks up the ball barehanded, and throws it across his body to first base, perpendicular to the direction he's running. Except that this cannot be done. You could never get enough velocity on the throw to get the out at first. So Zimmerman dives forward, leaving his feet and hovering there for an instant, his body parallel to the ground in order to get more arm extension and thus more on the throw, which by now is nearly underhanded, his fingers almost scraping the ground, batter out. Try this yourself. Aim for a barn door. You will miss and also dislocate your shoulder. Another attraction is rookie second baseman Danny Espinosa. He has what in baseball parlance is known as a range. A hard shot is hit to the hole between first and second, and Espy ranges to his left to snag it. 3 weeks ago, one shot was hit so hard and so deep that he had to dive onto the outfield grass to reach it, sliding on his side in the general direction of the right field foul pole. Nice grab, but unless you can get the ball to first, it's just for show. Espy starts to get up, but there's no time for standing. So, from his knees, while still sliding on the grass out towards the stands, he forces himself into a counterclockwise 180-degree spin to throw back toward first base. Except that he actually begins his throw mid-turn while facing the outfield, thereby gaining velocity from the centrifugal force and probably the rotation of the earth, although this remains unverified. It's like throwing on your knees from a spinning merry-go-round that is itself moving laterally in a landslide. Try that. Batter out. The pièce de résistance, however, is what center fielder Rick Ankiel pulled off last Sunday. It's the bottom of the ninth, one out. The Reds have just tied the game with a solo homer. They need one more run to win. Batter crushes the ball to right center field. If it clears the wall, game over. But it doesn't. It bounces off the wall, eluding our right fielder. Ankiel, who had dashed over from center, charges after the ball, picks it up barehanded, and in full running stride fires it to third, to which the batter is headed and from which he is very likely to later score and win the game, there being only one out. Now, when mortals throw a ball, they give it arc to gain distance. That's how artillery works. Ankiel is better than artillery. He releases the ball at the top of his throwing motion, the ball rocketing out as if tracing a clothesline. It bounces 5 feet from third base, perfectly on line, arriving a millisecond before the batter and maybe 20 inches above the bag. Quick tag, batter out, game saved. Blown 5 innings later, but remember it's the Nats. Said Nats broadcaster and former major leaguer F.P. Santangelo, "That might be the best throw I've ever seen." Me too, except that I didn't see it personally, as it were, only saw it on TV. They were playing in Cincinnati. I may be a fan, but I'm not a lunatic. I don't travel with the team. Yet. Yes, I know that the world is going to pieces, and that the prowess of 3 gifted players doesn't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. But I remind you that FDR wanted baseball to continue during World War II. I make no claim that elegance and grace on any field will ward off the apocalypse. But if it comes in summer, I'll be waiting for it at Nats Park, Section 128, hard by the Dippin' Dots. The Washington Post, September 1, 2011. Chapter 6, Heaven and Earth. You're only Haley's. A Lutheran minister once described comets as the thick smoke of human sins, a hypothesis that finds little support nowadays among scientists. They prefer to see comets as big, dirty snowballs trailing tails of gas and enthralled by gravitation, and coming not from God but from the equally ineffable Oort cloud, a gigantic shell far beyond the solar system, where aspiring comets spend eons of quiet desperation until disturbed by some celestial accident and called to race toward the sun and make men weep. Except that men don't weep anymore. Halley's Comet may have brought victory to the Normans in 1066, heralded the descent of Turkish armies on Belgrade in 1456, and in 1910 killed Mark Twain and then Edward VII. This time around, all is forgiven. After all, it knows not what it does, and we know what it is. A forlorn mass of rock and ice, a few miles across, caught in endless revolution around our sun. Now an object, not an omen, it is the source not of panic but of curiosity. 5 earthly spacecraft have been sent to greet it and snap its picture. Science has thoroughly desacralized the universe. It is in the language. When in the last election Walter Mondale warned against militarizing the heavens, the usage seemed quaint. After Neil Armstrong and George Lucas, what's up there now is simply space. The heavens were a place for angels, gods, and pretentious messengers. Space is home to extraterrestrials, the Force, and now snowballs cruising through emptiness. Don't get me wrong, I'm not pining for the days of the witch doctor. Things are much better now. There are costs to demystifying the universe and turning it over to science. The ubiquity of Carl Sagan is among the heavier ones, but the gain is great. Halley's, like the rest of space, is friendly now, tamed. This will probably be the first time in history that Halley's will bring wonder unalloyed with fear. Halley's has turned into a celebration, a scientific romance. The romance is in the return. Halley's comes back, always exactly on time. After its current pass, it will travel 3 billion miles away from Earth and then turn to revisit your children. It is the grandest reminder that an individual can behold of the constancy of nature. This because of its cycle. It returns about every 75 years, once in a lifetime. The sun rises regularly, too, but so often that we can't help being dulled to the wonder of its rhythm. And what rhythms beyond that of the familiar year really touch us? Sunspots come every 11 years, and what layman cares? Economists are forever coming up with long waves, 50 years, and other putative business cycles. Even Freud's theory of neurosis was built on the notion of a distant return, the return of the child to the mind of the man. Such cycles can most charitably be called speculative. Others are merely too long. The Ice Age will be back too. Fit that in your calendar. Halley's alone is made to human scale. Its span is precisely a lifetime. Birth and death are perhaps the only events that match Halley's periodicity, and neither is nearly as reliable. Birth and death come with regular irregularity, to borrow a term from cardiology. Halley's you can count on. We know, for example, absolutely nothing about what the world will be like in 2061, except one thing. In that unimaginable year, a year whose very number has an otherworldly look, Halley's will light up the sky. One price of demystifying the universe is that science, unlike religion, asks only how, not why. As to the purpose of things, science is silent. But if science cannot talk about meaning, it can talk about harmony. And Halley's is at once a symbol and a proof of a deep harmony of the spheres. The great author of that harmony was Newton, and one of the earliest empirical demonstrations of his gravitational theories was provided by his friend Edmund Halley. 23 years after the Great Comet of 1682, Halley deciphered its logic. He predicted its return in 1758. Halley died 17 years before he could be proved right. The return of the comet was a sensation. It made Halley immortal. True to its nature, science wed the comet forever to the man who did not discover it, but was the first to understand it. This time around, there will be no sensation. Halley's will give one of the worst shows ever. This may be its dimmest apparition in more than 2,000 years. What we will celebrate, then, is not the spectacle, but the idea. Halley's is a monument to science, a spokesman for its new celestial harmonies, and an intimation of mortality. It is at once recurring, and for us individually, singular. This will be my only Halley's, and if you're old enough to read this without moving your lips, your last one too, I'm afraid. Halley's speaks to me especially acutely. As it turns around the sun, the midpoint on its journey, I will be marking the midpoint in mine, or so say the Metropolitan Life tables. Our perihelions match. Mark Twain was rather pleased with the fact that he came in with Halley's and would go out with it. Ashes to ashes, Oort to Oort, hail Halley's. The Washington Post, December 13, 1985. Humbled by the Hayden. Bantam Books will soon reissue its updated illustrated edition of Stephen Hawking's wildly popular A Brief History of Time. Beware. As part-time scientific food taster for my readers, I can report that, having devoured Hawking's original book not once but twice, it leaves no trace. That is because it is entirely incomprehensible. Illustrating the book seems to me akin to tarting up hieroglyphics with Etruscan annotation. Want an invigorating scientific experience? I have a better idea. The new Hayden Planetarium in New York. The building itself is worth the trip. It is an immense 10-story cube of glass, inside of which seems to float a huge sphere, which houses the Sky Show viewing room, surrounded by a curving walkway, tracing the origins of the universe, seemingly suspended in the void. The intelligence of this design is as striking as its beauty. It is a brilliant metaphor for the attempt of the human imagination to wrap itself around the natural world. Why? Because apart from crystals, there are few straight lines in nature. Nature is more sinews, curves, waves, ellipses, and when we are blessed, perfect spheres. Look up at the sky. It is a festival of spheres. It is we, the bipeds, with the fat heads and the opposable thumbs, who impose straight lines on nature. We connect the dots between the stars to make dippers large and small. We take the human form, as in Vitruvian Man, the famous geometrical drawing by Leonardo and Cesariano and others, and fit it with axes, right angles, and diagonals. That is what we do to grasp the incomprehensible. And on a magnificent scale, that is what the new Hayden Building does. It wraps an enormous cube around interior curves and spheres, just as science creates the lines that give order and solidity to the bending ephemera of nature. That is your impression from the outside. Inside is even more thrilling. The vastness of the empty space of the cube allows for demonstrations of scale by analogy. You stand on the walkway, look down at a display housing a small ball, and a plaque informing you that if the ball represents Earth, the gigantic sphere hovering above you, the Sky Show Auditorium, represents the sun. Lessons in scale are everywhere. One corridor, for example, features wall-size composite photos taken by astronauts on the moon. You can see 100 pictures of the moon, but until you've seen one, the size of a storefront window, showing an astronaut in his little dune buggy in one tiny corner of the immensity of a desolate moonscape, you have not quite experienced the vastness of the void and the insignificance of man. And yet, oddly, that very insignificance adds to the glory of the creature that dares challenge such cosmic disparities. You feel it most acutely walking down the great floating ramp, where every inch represents 3.6 million years of the evolution of the universe, each stride 75 million. You trace the story from the Big Bang through dozens of Hubble telescope pictures displayed along the way. Then you come to now. You've been walking for about 20 minutes. You've traversed more than 100 yards. And you come upon a glass case containing nothing but a human hair and a little notification that on the scale of the events you have just traversed, the width of that hair represents all of human history. The Hayden Planetarium thus acts as a counterpart to the great Air and Space Museum in Washington. At Air and Space, everything is on a human scale, the Lindbergh plane, the jets, even the rockets are approachable. You can wrap, if not your arms, then your mind around them. It is the universe as seen and conquered by man. The Hayden is the unconquerable universe as seen by God. Air and Space is a shrine to human defiance. The Hayden is a palace of wonder. You come out of Air and Space exhilarated. You come out of Hayden humbled. Humbled in more ways than one. Some visitors are overwhelmed by the sophistication of the exhibits. The curators have chosen to talk down to no one. Be prepared to have Hubble's constant, a mathematical formula that represents the rate at which the universe is expanding, thrown out at you without a puppet show illustration. Indeed, just a month after Hayden reopened, the New York Times ran a piece summarizing visitors' complaints that the museum was often too difficult to grasp. In a culture where everything from textbooks to television to SATs has been renormed and dumbed down, one should be grateful for an intellectual challenge, a building devoted to explaining the cosmos that does not leave you scratching your head and humbled, has failed. The Hayden succeeds splendidly. The Washington Post, September 1st, 2000. Lit up for liftoff? Someone's got to do it. No one's gonna do it, so I'll do it. Your Honor, I rise in defense of drunken astronauts. You've heard all the reports delivered in scandalized tones on the evening news or as guaranteed punchlines for the late-night comics that at least two astronauts had alcohol in their systems before flights. A stern and sober NASA has assured an anxious nation that this matter, uncovered by a NASA commission study, will be thoroughly looked at and appropriately dealt with. To which I say, come off it. I know NASA has to get grim and do the responsible thing, but as counsel for the defense, the only counsel for the defense as far as I can tell, I place before the jury the following considerations. Have you ever been to the shuttle launch pad? Have you ever seen that beautiful and preposterous thing the astronauts ride? Imagine it's you sitting on top of a 12-story wing tube bolted to a gigantic canister filled with 2 million liters of liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen. Then picture your own buddies, the closeout crew, who met you at the pad, fastened your emergency chute, strapped you into your launch seat, sealed the hatch, and waved smiling to you through the window. Having left you lashed to what is the largest bomb on planet Earth, they then proceed 200 feet down the elevator, then drive not one, not two, but 3 miles away to watch as the button is pressed that lights the candle that ignites the fuel that blows you into space. 3 miles. That's how far they calculate they must go to be beyond the radius of incineration should anything go awry on the launch pad on which, I remind you, these insanely brave people are sitting. Would you not want to be a bit soused? Would you be all a flutter if you discover that a couple of astronauts out of dozens were mildly so? I dare say that if the standards of today's fussy flight surgeons had been applied to pilots showing up for morning duty in the Battle of Britain, the signs in Piccadilly would today be in German. Cut these cowboys some slack. These are not wobbly Northwest Airlines pilots trying to get off the runway and steer through clouds and densely occupied airspace. An ascending space shuttle, I assure you, encounters very little traffic. And for much of liftoff, the astronaut is little more than spam in a can, not pilot but guinea pig, with opposable thumbs to be sure, yet with only one specific task, to come out alive. And by the time the astronauts get to the part of the journey that requires delicate and skillful maneuvering, docking with the International Space Station, outdoor plumbing repairs in zero-G, they will long ago have peed the demon rum into their recycling units. Okay? The most dismaying part of this brouhaha is not the tipsy Captain Kirk or two, but the fact that space makes the news today only as mini-scandal or farce. It all started out as a great romance in the 1960s, yet by the 1970s, indeed the morning after the 1969 moon landing, romance had turned to boredom. When the Apollo 13 astronauts gave their live broadcast from space, not a single network carried it. No interest. Until, that is, the explosion that nearly killed them, at which point the world tuned in with rapt and morbid attention. Well, we are now in stage three of our space odyssey, mockery and amusement. The last big space story was the crazed lady astronaut on her diapered drive to a fatal attraction rendezvous. It's hard to entirely blame the state of affairs on a fickle public. Blame also belongs to the idiot politicians who decided 30 years ago to abandon the moon and send us on a pointless and endless journey into low Earth orbit. President Bush has sensibly called an end to this nonsense and committed us to going back to the moon and ultimately to Mars. If his successors don't screw it up, within 10 years NASA will have us back to where we belong, on other worlds. At which point we'll remember why we did this in the first place. And when we once again thrill at seeing humans on the moon, this time making it their home, we won't much care whether the extra bounce in their gait is the effect of the 1/6 gravity or of a touch of moonshine. The Washington Post, August 3, 2007. Farewell, the New Frontier. As the space shuttle Discovery flew three times around Washington, a final salute before landing at Dulles Airport for retirement in a museum, thousands on the ground gazed upward with marvel and pride. Yet what they were witnessing, for all its elegance, was a funeral march. The shuttle was being carried, its pallbearer a 747, because it cannot fly, nor will it ever again. It was being sent for interment, above ground to be sure, but just as surely embalmed as Lenin in Red Square. Is there a better symbol of willed American decline? The pity is not Discovery's retirement. Beautiful as it was, the shuttle proved too expensive and risky to operate, but that it died without a successor. The planned follow-on, the Constellation rocket capsule program to take humans back into orbit and from there to the moon, was suddenly canceled in 2010. And with that, control of manned spaceflight was gratuitously ceded to Russia and China. Russia went for the cash, doubling its price for carrying an astronaut into orbit to $55.8 million. Return included, thank you, Boris. China goes for the glory. Having already mastered launch and rendezvous, the Chinese plan to land on the moon by 2025. They understand well the value of symbols, and nothing could better symbolize China overtaking America than its taking our place on the moon, walking over footprints first laid down then casually abandoned by us. Who cares, you say? What is national greatness, scientific prestige, or inspiring the young, legacies of NASA, when we are in economic distress? Okay, but if we're talking jobs and growth, science and technology, R&D and innovation, what President Obama insists are the keys to an economy built to last, why on earth cancel an incomparably sophisticated, uniquely American technological enterprise? We lament the decline of American manufacturing, yet we stop production of the most complex machine ever made by man and cancel the successor meant to return us to orbit. The result? Abolition of thousands of the most highly advanced aerospace jobs anywhere, its workforce abruptly unemployed and drifting away from spaceflight, never to be reconstituted. Well, you say, we can't afford all that in a time of massive deficits. There are always excuses for putting off strenuous national endeavors. Deficits, joblessness, poverty, whatever. But they shall always be with us. We've had exactly 5 balanced budgets since Alan Shepard wrote Freedom 7 in 1961. If we had put off space exploration until these earthbound social and economic conundrums were solved, our rocketry would be about where North Korea's is today. Moreover, today's deficits are not inevitable nor even structural. They are partly the result of the 2008 financial panic and recession. Those are over now. The rest is the result of a massive 3-year expansion of federal spending. But there's no reason the federal government has to keep spending 24% of GDP. The historical post-war average is just over 20%, and those budgets sustained a robust manned space program. NASA will tell you that it's got a new program to go way beyond low Earth orbit and, as per Obama's instructions, land on an asteroid by the mid-2020s. Considering that Constellation did not last even 5 years between birth and cancellation, don't hold your breath for the asteroid landing, nor for the private sector to get us back into orbit, as Obama assumes it will. True, hauling MREs up and trash back down could be done by private vehicles, but manned flight is infinitely more complex and risky, requiring massive redundancy and inevitably larger expenditures. Can private entities really handle that? And within the next lost decade or two? Neil Armstrong, James Lovell, and Gene Cernan are deeply skeptical. Commercial transport to orbit, they wrote in a 2010 open letter, is likely to take substantially longer and be more expensive than we would hope. They called Obama's cancellation of Constellation a devastating decision that destines our nation to become one of second or even third-rate stature. Without the skill and experience that actual spacecraft operation provides, they warned, the USA is far too likely to be on a long downhill slide to mediocrity. This from the leading spacefaring nation for nearly half a century. Which is why museum visits to the embalmed discovery will be sad indeed. America rarely retreats from a new frontier, yet today we can't even do what John Glenn did in 1962, let alone fly a circa 1980 shuttle. At least discovery won't suffer the fate of the Tamarair, the British warship tenderly rendered in Turner's famous The Fighting Temeraire Tucked to Her Last Berth to be Broken Up, 1838. Too beautiful for the scrap heap, discovery will lie intact, a magnificent and melancholy rebuke to constricted horizons. The Washington Post, April 19, 2012. Are we alone in the universe? Huge excitement last week. 2 Earth-sized planets found orbiting a sun-like star less than 1,000 light-years away. This comes 2 weeks after the stunning announcement of another planet orbiting another star at precisely the right distance, within the habitable zone that is not too hot and not too cold, to allow for liquid water and therefore possible life. Unfortunately, the planets of the right size are too close to their sun and thus too scorching hot to permit Earth-like life. And the Goldilocks planet in the habitable zone is too large. At 2.4 times the size of Earth, it is probably gaseous, like Jupiter. No Earthlings there. But it's only a matter of time, perhaps a year or two, estimates one astronomer, before we find the right one of the right size in the right place. And at just the right time. As the romance of man's space exploration has waned, the drive today is to find our living, thinking counterparts in the universe. For all the excitement, however, the search betrays a profound melancholy. A lonely species in a merciless universe anxiously awaits an answering voice amid utter silence. That silence is maddening, not just because it compounds our feeling of cosmic isolation, but because it makes no sense. As we inevitably find more and more exoplanets where intelligent life can exist, why have we found no evidence, no signals, no radio waves, that intelligent life does exist? It's called the Fermi paradox, after the great physicist who once asked, "Where is everybody?" Or, as was once elaborated, all our logic, all our anti-isocentrism, assures us that we are not unique, that they must be there, and yet we do not see them. How many of them should there be? The Drake Equation, 1961, tries to quantify the number of advanced civilizations in just our own galaxy. To simplify slightly, it's the number of stars in the galaxy multiplied by the fraction that form planets, multiplied by the average number of planets in the habitable zone, multiplied by the fraction of these that give birth to life, multiplied by the fraction of these that develop intelligence, multiplied by the fraction of these that produce interstellar communications, multiplied by the fraction of the planet's lifetime during which such civilizations survive. Modern satellite data applied to the Drake Equation suggests that the number should be very high. So why the silence? Carl Sagan, among others, thought that the answer is to be found, tragically, in the final variable, the high probability that advanced civilizations destroy themselves. In other words, this silent universe is conveying not a flattering lesson about our uniqueness, but a tragic story about our destiny. It is telling us that intelligence may be the most cursed faculty in the entire universe, an endowment not just ultimately fatal, but on the scale of cosmic time, nearly instantly so. This is not mere theory. Look around. On the very day that astronomers rejoiced at the discovery of the two Earth-sized planets, the National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity urged two leading scientific journals not to publish details of lab experiments that had created a lethal and highly transmittable form of bird flu virus, lest that fateful knowledge fall into the wrong hands. Wrong hands, human hands. This is not just the age of holy terror, but also the threshold of an age of hyperproliferation. Nuclear weapons in the hands of half-mad tyrants, North Korea, and radical apocalypticists, Iran, are only the beginning. Lethal biologic agents may soon find their way into the hands of those for whom genocidal pandemics loosed upon infidels are the royal road to redemption. And forget the psychopaths. Why, a mere 17 years after Homo sapiens, born 200,000 years ago, discovered atomic power, those most stable and sober states, America and the Soviet Union, came within inches of mutual annihilation. Rather than despair, however, let's put the most hopeful face on the cosmic silence and on humanity's own short, already baleful history with its new Promethean powers. Intelligence is a capacity so godlike, so protean, that it must be contained and disciplined. This is the work of politics, understood as the ordering of society and the regulation of power to permit human flourishing while simultaneously restraining the most Hobbesian human instincts. There could be no greater irony. For all the sublimity of art, physics, music, mathematics, and other manifestations of human genius, everything depends on the mundane, frustrating, often debased vocation known as politics and its most exacting subspecialty, statecraft. Because if we don't get politics right, everything else risks extinction. We grow justly weary of our politics, but we must remember this. Politics and all its grubby, grasping, corrupt, contemptible manifestations is sovereign in human affairs. Everything ultimately rests upon it. Fairly or not, politics is the driver of history. It will determine whether we will live long enough to be heard one day, out there, by them, the few, the only, who got it right. The Washington Post, December 29, 2011.
Part 2. Political. Chapter 7. Citizen and State. Reflections on the Revolution in France. 200 years ago today, a mob stormed the Bastille and freed its 7 prisoners. 4 forgers, 2 lunatics, and an aristocrat imprisoned at his family's request for libertinism. It might have been 8 had not the Marquis de Sade, whose cell contained a desk, a wardrobe, a dressing table, tapestries, mattresses, velvet cushions, a collection of hats, 3 kinds of fragrances, night lamps, and 133 books, left a week earlier. When the battle was lost, the governor of the Bastille, a minor functionary named Bernard René de Launay, could have detonated a mountain of gunpowder, destroying himself, the mob, and much of the surrounding Faubourg Saint-Antoine. He chose instead to surrender. His reward was to be paraded through the street and cut down with knives and pistol shots. A pastry cook, named Denon, declining a sword, sawed off his head with a pocket knife. For the French Revolution, it was downhill from there on. Now, after 200 years, the French themselves seem finally to be coming to terms with that reality. There is a tentativeness to this week's bicentennial celebration that suggests that French enthusiasm for the revolution has tempered. This circumspection stems from 2 decades of revisionist scholarship that stresses the reformist impulses of the Ancien Régime and the murderous impulses of the revolutionary regime that followed. Simon Schama's Citizens is but the culmination of this trend. But the receptivity to such revisionism stems from something deeper, the death of doctrinaire socialism, which in France had long claimed direct descent from the revolution. Disillusion at the savage failure of the revolutions in our time, Russian, Chinese, Cuban, Vietnamese, has allowed reconsideration of the event that was father to them all. One might say that romance with revolution died with Solzhenitsyn. The line from the Bastille to the Gulag is not straight, but the connection is unmistakable. Modern totalitarianism has its roots in 1789. The spirit of the French Revolution has always been present in the social life of our country, said Gorbachev during his visit to France last week. Few attempts at ingratiation have been more true or more damning. Indeed, the French Revolution was such a model for future revolutions that it redefined the word. That is why 1776 has long been treated as a kind of pseudo-revolution, as Irving Kristol pointed out in a prescient essay written during America's confused and embarrassed bicentennial celebration of 1976. The American Revolution was utterly lacking in the messianic, bloody-minded idealism of the French. It rearranged the constitutional furniture. Its revolutionary leaders died in their own beds. What kind of revolution was that? 13 years later, Crystal's answer has become conventional wisdom. A successful revolution, perhaps the only successful revolution of our time. The French Revolution failed, argues Schama, because it tried to create the impossible, a regime both of liberty and of patriotic state power. The history of the revolution is proof that these goals are incompatible. The American Revolution succeeded because it chose one, liberty. The Russian Revolution became deranged when it chose the other, state power. The French Revolution, to its credit and sorrow, wanted both. Its great virtue was to have loosed the idea of liberty upon Europe. Its great vice was to have created the model, the monster of the mobilized, militarized state. Revolutionary France invented universal conscription, that scourge of the 20th century only now beginning to wither away. The French cannot be blamed for everything, alas, but their revolution, with its glamour and influence, did not only popularize, it deified revolution. There are large parts of the world where even today the worst brutality and arbitrariness are justified by the mere invocation of the word revolution, without reference to any other human value. For the Chinese authorities to shoot a dissident in the back of the head, they have only to show that he is a counter-revolutionary. In Cuba, General Arnaldo Ochoa Sanchez, erstwhile hero of the revolution, is condemned to death in a show trial, and upon receiving his sentence, confesses his sins and declares that, at his execution, his last thought would be of Fidel and of the Great Revolution. The fate, then, of all messianic revolution, revolution that is on the French model, is that in the end it can justify itself and its crimes only by reference to itself. In Saint-Just's famous formulation, the Republic consists in the extermination of everything that opposes it. This brutal circularity of logic is properly called not revolution, but nihilism. The Washington Post, July 14, 1989. Did the state make you great? If you've got a business, you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen. Barack Obama, Roanoke, Virginia, July 13, 2012. And who might that somebody else be? Government, says Obama. It built the roads you drive on. It provided the teacher who inspired you. It created the internet. It represents the embodiment of we're in this together social solidarity that, in Obama's view, is the essential origin of individual and national achievement. To say that all individuals are embedded in and the product of society is banal. Obama rises above banality by means of fallacy, equating society with government, the collectivity with the state. Of course, we are shaped by our milieu, but the most formative, most important influence on the individual is not government. It is civil society, those elements of the collectivity that lie outside government, family, neighborhood, church, Rotary Club, PTA, the voluntary associations that Tocqueville understood to be the genius of America and source of its energy and freedom. Moreover, the greatest threat to a robust, autonomous civil society is the ever-growing Leviathan state and those like Obama who see it as the ultimate expression of the collective. Obama compounds the fallacy by declaring the state to be the font of entrepreneurial success. How so? It created the infrastructure, roads, bridges, schools, internet, off which we all thrive. Absurd. We don't credit the Swiss Postal Service with the special theory of relativity because it transmitted Einstein's manuscript to the Annalen der Physik. Everyone drives the roads, goes to school, uses the mails. So did Steve Jobs. Yet only he created the Mac and the iPad. Obama's infrastructure argument is easily refuted by what is essentially a controlled social experiment. Roads and schools are the constant. What's variable is the energy, enterprise, risk-taking, hard work, and genius of the individual. It is therefore precisely those individual characteristics, not the communal utilities, that account for the different outcomes. The ultimate Obama fallacy, however, is the conceit that belief in the value of infrastructure, and willingness to invest in its creation and maintenance is what divides liberals from conservatives. More nonsense. Infrastructure is not a liberal idea, nor is it particularly new. The Via Appia was built 2,300 years ago. The Romans built aqueducts, too, and sewers. Since forever, infrastructure has been consensually understood to be a core function of government. The argument between left and right is about what you do beyond infrastructure. It's about transfer payments and redistributionist taxation, about geometrically expanding entitlements, about tax breaks and subsidies to induce actions pleasing to central planners. It's about free contraceptives for privileged students and welfare without work, the latest Obama entitlement by decree that would fatally undermine the great bipartisan welfare reform of 1996. It's about endless government handouts that, ironically, are crowding out necessary spending on, yes, infrastructure. What divides liberals and conservatives is not roads and bridges, but Julia's World, an Obama campaign creation that may be the most self-revealing parody of liberalism ever conceived. It's a series of cartoon illustrations in which a fictional Julia is swaddled and subsidized throughout her life by an all-giving government of bottomless pockets and queen for a day magnanimity. At every stage, the state is there to provide preschool classes and cut-rate college loans, birth control and maternity care, business loans and retirement. The only time she's on her own is at her gravesite. Julia's world is totally atomized. It contains no friends, no community, and of course, no spouse. Who needs one? She's married to the provider state. Or to put it slightly differently, the life of Julia represents the paradigmatic Obama political philosophy, citizen as orphan child. For the conservative, providing for every need is the duty that government owes to actual orphan children, not to supposedly autonomous adults. Beyond infrastructure, the conservative sees the proper role of government as providing not European-style universal entitlements, but a firm safety net, meaning Julia-like treatment for those who really cannot make it on their own, those too young or too old, too mentally or physically impaired to provide for themselves. Limited government, so conceived, has two indispensable advantages. It avoids inexorable European-style national insolvency, and it avoids breeding debilitating individual dependency. It encourages and celebrates character, independence, energy, hard work as the foundations of a free society and a thriving economy, precisely the virtues Obama discounts and devalues in his accounting of the wealth of nations. The Washington Post, July 19, 2012. Constitutionalism. For decades, Democrats and Republicans fought over who owns the American flag. Now they're fighting over who owns the Constitution. The flag debates began during the Vietnam era when leftist radicals made the fatal error of burning it. For decades since, non-suicidal liberals have tried to undo the damage. Demeaningly and somewhat unfairly, they are forever having to prove their fealty to the flag. Amazingly, though, some still couldn't get it quite right. During the last presidential campaign, candidate Barack Obama, asked why he was not wearing a flag pin, answered that it represented a substitute for true patriotism. Bad move. Months later, Obama quietly beat a retreat and began wearing the flag on his lapel. He does so still. Today, the issue is the Constitution. It's a healthier debate because flags are pure symbolism and therefore more likely to evoke pure emotion, an ad hominem argument. The Constitution, on the other hand, is a document that speaks. It defines concretely the nature of our social contract. Nothing in our public life is more substantive. Americans are in the midst of a great national debate over the power, scope, and reach of the government established by that document. The debate was sparked by the current administration's bold push for government expansion, a massive fiscal stimulus, Obamacare, financial regulation, and various attempts at controlling the energy economy. This engendered a popular reaction, identified with the Tea Party, but in reality far more widespread, calling for a more restrictive vision of government more consistent with the founders' intent. Call it constitutionalism. In essence, constitutionalism is the intellectual counterpart and spiritual progeny of the originalism movement in jurisprudence. Judicial originalists, led by Antonin Scalia and other notable conservative jurists, insist that legal interpretation be bound by the text of the Constitution as understood by those who wrote it and their contemporaries. Originalism has grown to become the major challenger to the liberal living constitution school, under which high courts are channelers of the spirit of the age, free to create new constitutional principles accordingly. What originalism is to jurisprudence, constitutionalism is to governance, a call for restraint rooted in constitutional text. Constitutionalism as a political philosophy represents a reformed, self-regulating conservatism that bases its call for minimalist government, for reining in the willfulness of presidents and legislatures in the words and meaning of the Constitution. Hence, that highly symbolic moment on Thursday when the 112th House of Representatives opened with a reading of the Constitution. Remarkably, this had never been done before, perhaps because it had never been so needed. The reading reflected the feeling expressed powerfully in the last election that we have moved far, especially the past 2 years, from a government constitutionally limited by its enumerated powers to a government constrained only by its perception of social need. The most galvanizing example of this expansive shift was, of course, the Democrats' health care reform, which will revolutionize 1/6 of the economy and impose an individual mandate that levies a fine on anyone who does not enter into a private contract with a health insurance company. Whatever its merits as policy, there is no doubting its seriousness as constitutional precedent. If Congress can impose such a mandate, is there anything that Congress may not impose upon the individual? The new Republican House will henceforth require, in writing, constitutional grounding for every bill submitted. A fine idea, although I suspect 90% of them will simply make a ritual appeal to the General Welfare Clause. Nonetheless, anything that reminds members of Congress that they are not untethered free agents is salutary, but still mostly symbolic. The real test of the Republicans' newfound constitutionalism will come in legislating. Will they really cut government spending? Will they really roll back regulations? Earmarks are nothing. Do the Republicans have the courage to go after entitlements as well? In the interim, the cynics had best tread carefully. Some liberals are already disdaining the new constitutionalism, denigrating the document's relevance and sneering at its public recitation. They sneer at their political peril. In choosing to focus on a majestic document that bears both study and recitation, the reformed conservatism of the Obama era has found itself not just a symbol, but an anchor. Constitutionalism as a guiding political tendency will require careful and thoughtful development, as did jurisprudential originalism. But its wide appeal and philosophical depth make it a promising first step to a conservative future. The Washington Post, January 7, 2011. Myth of the Angry White Male. The angry white male, suitably capitalized to indicate that the menace has become a media-certified trend, stalks the land, or at least the land of the media. In the 10 years before the November 1994 election, there were 59 Nexus references to angry white men. There have been 1,400 since. A post-election front-page headline in USA Today was typical: angry white men. Their votes turned the tide for the GOP. By sheer numbing repetition, the legend grows. The Republicans scraped together a majority, explains the genial Garrison Keillor, by appealing to the sorehead vote, your brother-in-law and mine. By early April, the term receives its official presidential seal of approval when Bill Clinton confirms that this is psychologically a difficult time for a lot of white males, the so-called angry white males. Then comes Oklahoma City, and the legend has its poster boy, khaki-clad, hopping mad, armed and dangerous. Have angry white men gone too far? Asks the Wall Street Journal in a front-page headline right after the bombing. Apparently, yes. Heartbreaking Oklahoma News reports, explains the Journal, show the lengths to which the anger of the much commented upon angry white males can extend. The Oklahoma bomber is now honorary class president of those conservative-leaning, Republican-voting, agitated white males the media have been warning us about since November. First, he gives Newt Gingrich the House. Then he blows up the federal building in Oklahoma City. Where did this legend come from? Yes, white men shifted significantly toward Republicans in the November election. But where did the ubiquitous pejorative angry come from? Where is the evidence for the rage of this white male cohort? Anyone take their blood pressure in the voting booth? USA Today's front page angry white men story is again typical. It offered reams of polls, not one supporting the supposed anger of white men. Indeed, of the dozens of polls taken around Election Day, I could find only three that even raised the issue. Frank Luntz asked voters if they considered themselves angry voters. 7 out of 10 white men did not. The Voter News Service National Exit Poll asked respondents if they were angry about the way the federal government works. 3 out of 4 white males were not. The Washington Post ABC pre-election poll asked the same question. 4 out of 5 white males were not. Moreover, the 21% who were exactly matches the average percentage of Americans overall who have identified themselves as angry in the last 10 such polls stretching back to early 1992. Where is the hormonally challenged, mad-as-hell, sexist, racist mob that ran the Democrats out of Congress in 1994? The absence of facts must not be allowed to stand in the way of a good line or an ad hominem charge. And the charge of male anger has a history that predates the 1994 election. It began its recent career as the ultimate put-down of those critical of the first ladyhood of Hillary Clinton. As she herself explained in an interview in the Wall Street Journal on September 30th, "People are not really often reacting to me so much as they are reacting to their own lives. If somebody has a female boss for the first time, and they've never experienced that, well, maybe they can't take out their hostility against her, so they turn it on me." Keeler puts it again more genially when he dubs the Republicans the party of large white men who feel uneasy around gals. Clinton pollster Stanley Greenberg echoes the theme when he writes about Republicans becoming a home for every angry group, among them those who resent strong women. Really? Let's look at Maryland. State Delegate Ellen Saubry, who last year lost the closest gubernatorial race in the country, is a Republican. She is a tough independent politician, so tough, in fact, that for 9 weeks she doggedly tried to overturn what she charged was a tainted election before deigning to concede to her male opponent. So here's a test of the Clinton-Keeler-Greenberg proposition. How did white males, so fearful and resentful of strong women, vote in Maryland? For Mrs. Saubry, by a 2-to-1 landslide. The New York Times post-election coverage cited speculation that apathy among women voters might have contributed to the huge Democratic losses of 1994. It noted a lack of interest this year among women compared with 1992, the so-called Year of the Woman, when the fracas between Clarence Thomas and Professor Anita F. Hill energized women voters. Women, you see, are energized. Men are enraged. When women show electoral clout, it is the Year of the Woman. When men do, it is the year of the angry white male. In fact, the angry white male is a myth, an invention of political partisans who wish to rationalize and ultimately delegitimize the election of 1994. After all, neither anger nor whiteness nor maleness is a coveted attribute these days. The invention of the angry white male pointedly ascribes the current Republican ascendancy to a toxic constituency akin to the petty bourgeoisie that brought fascists to power in the Europe of the 1930s. A rabble of dispossessed white men, threatened by women, resentful of minorities, enthralled by talk radio, has been stirred, and that's why the Republicans won. The myth is not just useful, but comforting, too. Defeat becomes tolerable, indeed virtuous, when you've convinced yourself that you lost to a lynch mob. The Washington Post, May 26, 1995. Going negative. Delta Airlines, you might have noticed, does not run negative TV ads about U.S. Air. It does not show pictures of the crash of U.S. Air Flight 427 with a voiceover saying, "U.S. Air, airline of death, Going to Pittsburgh? Fly Delta instead. And McDonald's, you might also have noticed, does not run ads reminding viewers that Jack in the Box hamburgers once killed two customers. Why? Because Delta and McDonald's know that if the airline and fast food industries put on that kind of advertising, America would soon be riding trains and eating box lunch tuna sandwiches. Yet, every 2 years, the American politics industry fills the airwaves with the most virulent, scurrilous, wall-to-wall character assassination of nearly every political practitioner in the country, and then declares itself puzzled that America has lost trust in its politicians. Voters declare a burning desire to throw the bums out. Polls show an aversion to politicians that can only be called malignant. And the sages pull on their beards, stumped. The economy? It is in better shape than it has been in years. Gridlock? People so thoroughly disgusted with their politicians want gridlock, they approve of a system that promises to stop them before they legislate again. It is not the system they dislike. It is the players they cannot abide. Why? No need for exotic theories. The simplest explanation is always the best. Politics is the only American industry whose participants devote their advertising budgets to the regular, public, savage undermining of one another. It is the only American industry whose participants devote prodigious sums to destroying whatever shred of allegiance any of them might once have won with their customers. Compare. About the only other business that indulges in negative advertising is the long-distance phone business. MCI tells you that AT&T overcharges. Not so, says AT&T. This piddling stuff is about as nasty as it gets. Moreover, picking a long-distance operator hardly demands a relationship of trust. Whereas picking an airline that suspends you in a sealed aluminum tube at 30,000 feet is a matter of trust. So is picking a fast food restaurant that presents you with heavily camouflaged meat confected by a 16-year-old with acne. So is picking a politician who rifles your paycheck and regulates your life. Yet only the politicians work systematically to kill that trust. Turn on the tube and watch what one candidate, any candidate, has to say about the other. Then remember that no matter who wins, one of these miserable, execrable human beings will end up representing you in Congress. Senator John Danforth of Missouri recalls that in his first Senate race in 1970, he ran against the popular Stuart Symington and lost. Yet both ran such positive and honorable campaigns that Danforth ended up one of the best-liked politicians in Missouri. 6 years later, he ran again and won. That was a long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Danforth is retiring now from a political environment turned toxic. The politicians have since gone negative. The reason is simple. Negative works. It gets individuals elected. Add up all the individual acts of political homicide, however, and you have a political class that is collectively committing suicide. The basic theme of the 1994 campaign is that everyone running is a liar, a cheat, a crook, or a fraud. Take the, 3rd District of Tennessee, Button versus Womp. Womp portrays Button as a fraud. Button calls Womp a liar and compliments Womp for kicking his chemical dependency. A nice touch. And the most publicized case of mutual assured political destruction, the Virginia Senate race. Oliver North's TV ad starts with, "Why can't Chuck Robb tell the truth?" Which Robb's answers with, "After lying about President Reagan and even lying to school children, now Oliver North is lying about Chuck Robb." To school children, mind you. The immutable fact is this. As of November 9th, one of these two highly advertised liars will be the next senator from Virginia. Every state in the Union will be sending to Congress some brutally excoriated campaign survivor. The 104th Congress is guaranteed to be an assembly of the most vilified persons in every American community. And you thought the baseball owners were self-destructive. Do we really need seminars on why voters loathe politicians? The Washington Post, October 28th, 1994. The Tirana Index. Now that the campaign is over and the returns are in, analysis of the latest Albanian election begins. The facts are clear. Communist Party chief Enver Hoxha's slate of candidates for parliament won by the comfortable margin of 1,627,959-1. The message seems to be, stay the course. The party ran well in all regions and among all classes, worker, peasant, and apparatchik. It swept the atheist vote. The much-ballyhooed gender gap never developed. On the other hand, it failed to make any inroads on opposition support. In the last Albanian election, there was also one vote against. Some observers had been predicting that opposition support might double. But that prospect dimmed last December when a potential leader of the movement, Prime Minister Mehmet Shehu, committed suicide. At the time, Hoxha claimed that Shehu did so in a moment of nervous crisis. Now, party chairman Hoxha, himself a successful candidate in the 210th district of Tirana, writes the New York Times, says that Mr. Shehu, whom he described variously as an American agent, a Soviet agent, and a Yugoslav agent, had been ordered by Yugoslavia to kill Mr. Hoxha and other Albanian leaders, but finally met his demise when he broke his head against the unity of the party and the people. Mr. Hoxha's equivocation recalls the answer that the police captain in Casablanca gave to a question about the condition of a prisoner. We are trying to decide whether he committed suicide or died trying to escape. Since Albanian election law does not permit absentee ballots, analysts conclude that the one vote against Hoxha could not have been cast by Mr. Shehu. His voice will be missed. Hoxha's victory margin, though impressive, is not unprecedented. President Assad of Syria won re-election in 1978 with 99.6% of the vote. The Soviet embassy informs us that candidates always win more than 99% of the vote, usually around 99.5%. Indeed, it seems anything less than 99% is considered a vote of no confidence. Western observers are generally skeptical about these results. Because of their obsession with the authenticity of such elections, they tend to overlook their enormous value as scientific tools. For generations, political science has been seeking a way to quantify freedom. Some, like Freedom House, annually classify countries according to their level of political and civil liberty. Others, like Morton Kondracki, propose the creation of a computerized despot-o-meter to take the guesswork out of such perennially taxing questions as, who's worse, Idi Amin or Roberto d'Aubuisson? The trouble with these pioneering schemes is that they are too complicated. I propose a simpler system, crude, but like all crude instruments, quick, easy to use, and blunt. It is the Tirana Index. The higher the vote any government wins in an election, the more tyrannous it is. The Tirana Index lends itself to easy rules of thumb. Very bad tyranny, known to some as totalitarian states, usually gets more than 95% of the vote, and the more efficient of these, more than 99%. Traditional autocracies and military governments, known to some as authoritarian states, such as Turkey and Mexico, can be counted on to clock in somewhere between 80% and 95%. Turkey's last referendum passed by 92%. Well-functioning democracies produce winners who get between 50% and 80% of the vote. Countries like Italy, Israel, and others where driving is a life-threatening activity regularly produce winning margins of less than 50%. They can safely be classified as anarchies. The New Republic, December 13th, 1982.